Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, stemming the tide of Christians leaving the Middle East, a new Jordan-based initiative attempts to address the problem. Empowering women on the World Wide Web, a pontifical university offers a new master's program with a heavyweight cast of internet giants. And Our Lady's Yes to the Lord. Sister Toni Harris reflects on being everyday witnesses to the Virgin Mary's openness to Christ. Stopping the exodus of Christians from the Middle East. Jordan's Prince Hassan ibn Talal recently launched a two-day summit in Amman to kick off a campaign to raise awareness about the problem and search for ways to stem the tide. Prince Talal said the Arab Christians are Arabs and are the pioneers of thought and Arab revival. They are authentic and genuine in their countries. While the first meeting in March was hosted by the Jordanian Royal Institute of Interfaith Studies in Jordan, in cooperation with the Syrian Orthodox Archdiocese of Aleppo and the Mennonite Central Committee. Participants included bishops, religious, researchers and scholars, Muslims and Christians, and were from Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, Iraq, Egypt, Sudan and Iran. Emer McCarthy spoke with Jesuit Father Samir Khalil Samir, an Egyptian-born scholar of Islam, about the initiative.
The weakest part of the society are the Christians. Numerically, they don't exceed 10%, except in Lebanon, and in many parts is only 2 to 3%. So they are too weak to protect themselves. And what happens is that a lot of them are going to Canada, America, Australia, Europe, leaving the Muslim world, the Arab world. And this is the danger. That's why the Prince Hassan asked for a meeting to change this and to stop this movement and to tell to Christians, please remain in this area. We need you. You are a part of our Arab society. You are true Arabs. As he said very clearly, you contributed to the Arab civilization more than anybody else. We need you. Remain. The conditions to remain is to be recognized practically by the constitutions as true citizens, having the same rights of citizenship and equality of everybody. But this is the weak point in the Muslim societies. They consider usually that Muslims are automatically the highest citizens, those who had to command. The others, practically Christians, Jews, they have to be under the authority of the first group. This was already thought so by the founder of Islam, Muhammad himself. He distinguished in the society three groups: the believers, that means the Muslims, the unbelievers, they had to be fought until they die or they convert to Islam. These were called the kuffar, plural of kafir. And the third group is in between, the Christians and the Jews. These are called dhimmi, which means protected on the condition that they remain submitted to the first group. So this is still happening today, even if officially there is no more dhimmi and ummi, but in fact they deal like that you are certainly citizen, but in fact you are second-class citizens. And many Christians are fed up with this situation and they leave if they can.
Father Samir, in fact, Prince Hassan bin Talal has called for what he describes as an Arab social charter to help protect and, shall we say, promote the Christian presence in Arab countries.
Right.
In your opinion, as a scholar of Islam, as someone who was born and who has lived in these countries and has a great experience of this culture, what must this Arab social charter entail to ensure that the Christian presence can remain in the Middle East?
It could be said in an easy way, just to apply the Human Rights Charter, which is in fact not applied. I mean the Charter of 48. Absolute equality between all groups, religious groups, sexual groups, any kind of groups, between men and women, between believers and unbelievers, between Muslims and non-Muslims. This is the first point. The other point is to recognize the absolute equality of all persons, whether they are rich or poor, the democracy. The problem is that most Muslims would say, well, democracy is something typically Muslims, because we had the Shura. The Shura is the consultation that Muhammad was said to have done with some people. But this has nothing to do with democracy. This is just one aspect, a small one. They say, we don't make any difference. But if you read the Quran, you see that there are a lot of differences between the categories I mentioned, believers and unbelievers, men and women, Muslims and non-Muslims, and so on. Even the race is not mentioned, but in fact, Arabs are considering themselves, we are considering ourselves as the highest and the best group. And also the Quran is comforting this approach by saying, you are the best nation ever came out in the world. And the you could be understood as you Muslims or you Arabs. So what we need is a new charter, like the charter of the United Nations, and just accept the universal principles. But Muslims tend to go back in every point to the Quran, and the Quran is reflecting the situation of the 7th century in the Arab desert.
In fact, Father Samir, speaking about another document in defense of democracy and religious freedom released by Al-Azhar University, you spoke about the fact that until there is a revisitation of the interpretation of the Quran within the Muslim world, we can't really speak about any progress or move forward. But yeah. Prince Hassan has also called for Al-Azhar to hold a meeting on this issue, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it's true. When we speak in abstract, Muslims will use this terminology. They would say, we defend democracy and religious freedom and so on. If you go further, if you say, okay, religious freedom, Al-Azhar didn't mention the conversion, the possibility of converting from Islam, for instance, to Christianity or Judaism. They never mentioned the atheist, the possibility of being non-believer. And this belonged to religious freedom. But they spoke generally. In the Constitution, if we observe the Sharia, as it is normally a precept in the Egyptian Constitution, for instance, the Article 2, pretend that the basis of all laws is the Sharia. The Sharia, if we apply it literally, you have to kill the apostate. The apostate means the Muslim who abandoned Islam to adopt another religion. If he don't proclaim his change, if he proclaim he is Muslim, even if he is not a believer, he could live. But if he proclaim, I am a Christian, then he must be killed. Now, where is religious freedom? Even in Egypt, where Al-Azhar proclaimed it, in fact, is theoretical, is just to say we are open-minded, we are, and so on. Recently, the great imam of Saudi Arabia, the leading Muslim country in the world. The Imam, the great Imam of Mecca, said, we cannot accept any church on the ground of the Peninsula Arabica. And he was answering to someone asking him from Kuwait, you have to destroy all the churches which are on your ground in Kuwait or elsewhere in this area. Based not on fanaticism. He says, no, I am applying the Sharia because there is a hadith, that means a saying attributed to the founder Muhammad. There is a hadith which says, in Arabia, there cannot be two religions, which means there is only one, which is Islam.
Father Samir Khalil Samir of the Pontifical Oriental Institute. Empowering women in the church and in the world to harness the potential of new media to improve their professional skills and, why not, to evangelize. That's the aim of the Institute for Higher Women's Studies at the Rome-based Pontifical Athenaeum Regina Apostolorum, which recently added a high-powered program to its curricula featuring experts from Google, Microsoft, Facebook, TED, and other heavyweights in the field of digital and social communications. Computer security experts offer hands-on training, beginning with how to protect internet users from online identity and financial theft. Students also learn how to create online businesses and to develop marketing and advertising skills. Online ethics and how to promote Christian values are also themes discussed. But just why is a pontifical university sponsoring such a program? Giovanna Abbiati, Vice Director of the Athenaeum's Institute for Higher Women's Studies, says they wanted to respond to the Pope's call to know and evangelize through the digital media.
We wanted to answer to the call of the Pope about knowing the digital language, which is new, and we consider ourselves as women as a new media, because we are quite new and we want to communicate efficiently, and so that's why we propose this master in collaboration with Google.
And you also have involved other big names in the media world.
You know, the problem is that at the beginning we did this choice. Why don't we call directly those who make the communication in terms of technologies, the big expert? We don't choose big professors who probably wrote very interesting books on communication and new media. We really wanted to ask to those who communicate and do the communication. So we first asked with Google. We have very good relation with Google, and then we tried Microsoft, and at the end, Facebook. And we just called them, just help us. We want to be able to use the web, the potential of the web. We want to be trained how to communicate our values, our messages, and also how to make money, fundraising, for example. And they answered, yes, okay. We're very happy to help. So, for example, in this master, Google just sent us three teachers, very, very good. And we talk about ethics in the matter of, for example, you know, all the problems with the privacy, with the use of the Creative Commons for downloading, uploading content on the web. And the other things is the right of oblivium, which is that everybody has to be able just to cancel what he's doing on the web.
And all the information pertaining to them.
Exactly. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So this is very important, so because we must be responsible in the web. And they want the same. We want rules, ethics, and they want the same, and they also want good content on the web, because if you don't trust the web, you don't use it well, and you don't find anything, you don't trust the web, you don't make a transition, economic transition, you don't use your credit card, you don't want to allow anybody to use, for example, your children. So they want responsible people. Of course, they are discussing about rules. And we are discussing, too, also the relations with the technology. A human being, for example, children, they spend a lot of time in internet. And we must be able to teach them as mothers and as educators how to behave and how to use technologies.
Sure. What is safe, what's not safe, how to discern what is an accurate website to something that is just someone expressing an opinion, which could be very dangerous as well for our kids.
That's why we asked the police, the Italian police, Polizia Postale Italiana, to come and teach us how to be protected by informatic crimes. So talking about how to protect our children and ourselves with the danger of the web, because, of course, there is also this side to know well.
Sure. It seems to me that one of the other challenges that's represented by the new media that we're seeing is that in some way they are deciding what we want to know. Through their elaborate algorithms, companies like Google see that we are interested in, I don't know, in a certain political party, say, if you're in America, say the Republicans or the Democrats, and they can see that you've been downloading all the information about the Republicans, and so they send you only the Republican side of the things that you're looking for. But it doesn't allow you the dialogue with your opponents or the other side. So the dialogue is not there. We're sort of being taken down one track and not given more opinions, more sides of the story.
That's a good question. I'm very glad you made me this question. That's why we call the number one to teach us how the web and internet, which are two different things, is built. We didn't want to have a course, for example, about, you know, the up-to-date softwares, but we call the W3 Consortium. The W3 Consortium is the one who founded Tim Berners-Lee. Tim Berners-Lee is the founder, the inventor of the web. And is a foundation, so they don't sell anything. And we ask them to come and to teach how the web and internet is built, the architecture of the web, how the algorithm is made, how you can build a searching engine. So I think to go to the foundation, mechanical foundation, and also the thinking of the web was very important for all these educators and for people like me or like us, like a lot of other women who want to not only to be up to date, but to have an idea of what really technology is.
Here at this point in time, we're going through an economic crisis that has affected the whole world. In Italy, you're seeing shops close. We're seeing people being laid off their jobs. What opportunities can people find on the web?
Well, that's another part which is very important in our master, for example, the entrepreneurial spirit. For the first time, we think about the computer as a domestic tool. I mean, like a washing machine, which is an algorithm as well, but the computer is more intelligent. We heard about so many examples of startups, not only in the Silicon Valley, but also in Italy, we have examples of excellence that are able to, you know, to make money with the startup, this new idea, because the world is digitalizing everything, so it's a new field, it's a new world. So why don't we try also to empower women, stay-at-home workers, or stay-at-home persons like mothers who have to raise children or just to take care of old parents, to discover the potential of the web in terms of making a business. Why not? It's very easy to learn. You don't need 5 years of academic studies to get a degree. You don't need that. In a year, you can be able to open a website and be very good on the web. And that's something we ask directly to the number one, to Microsoft. We called Roberta Cocco, the director of social responsibility in Italy of Microsoft, and she's giving a course about digital marketing, how to open a website, how to deal with, you know, if you want to sell something, if you want to open a blog and to make money, because this is very important also for a woman in a family who wants to help.
The new evangelization, a big theme of Pope Benedict XVI's papacy, how can the internet empower women to promote the new evangelization through the web?
I think that being in a pontifical university, we are in touch with a great spiritual resource. We have all this tradition very close to us. We can read books, we can listen to very interesting people in Catholic Church. So I think that for the first time, we can have the chance to make a bridge between tradition and innovation. Innovation is modern, is the language that everybody understands. It's the language of the world, probably technology. But of course, tradition is very important because it means that it's something we receive from the past and from the others. It cannot die. So just these two things, traditions and innovation together, can be very strong for a new evangelization, can be the right spirit just to go ahead with a new language, can reach the young people from all over the earth, with a very persuasive language, but at the same time, the richness of a tradition which is very old, very deep, and needs probably a new translation.
Warm thanks there to Giovanna Abbiati, Vice Director of the Institute for Higher Women's Studies at the Pontifical Athenaeum Regina Apostolorum. It is a day to remember the Blessed Virgin's yes to the Lord. On the Feast of the Annunciation, Catholics celebrate the angel Gabriel's appearance to the Virgin Mary, announcing that she has been chosen to be the mother of our Lord. Usually celebrated on March 25th, the feast can be transferred to another date if it falls on a Sunday in Lent. In the following reflection, Sister Toni Harris, justice and peace promoter for the Dominican Sisters International, tells us how we, like Mary, can welcome Christ in our everyday lives.
A few years ago, another sister and I traveled from the United States to Rome for a meeting. Since we were going to Italy, we decided to visit Florence. We were especially interested in seeing the wonderful work of the Dominican artist Fra Angelico, or Fra Giovanni, of Fiesole. In the mid-15th century, Fra Angelico lived many years in the monastery of San Marco in Florence. Most of this monastery is now a museum. On the walls and in the rooms there, Fra Angelico painted many frescoes, most of which depict Dominic miraculously present in important events in the life of Christ. However, as one climbs the staircase to the second level of the monastery and rounds the corner, a large fresco of the Annunciation rises up at the top of the stairs. Now, by large, I mean 7.5 feet by 10.5 feet, more than 2 meters by 3 meters. The beautiful painting is in a position that assures an overwhelming emotional impact on the viewer. As we froze on the staircase in awe of the more than 5 centuries-old painting, my sister companion said to me, "If seeing this fresco was all that we did during our trip to Italy, it would have been enough." I had to agree. The 25th of March is the date when we usually celebrate the church solemnity that Fra Angelico's fresco depicts. However, it seems to me that the event of the Annunciation should be considerably more overwhelming for us than the painting. A young woman, Mary of Nazareth, agreed to a mysterious invitation. Behold, you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you shall name him Jesus. He will be called Great and will be called Son of the Most High. Giving us an example of openness to the divine mystery, Mary agrees to what she could not have fully understood. Her willingness to participate in this mystery made it possible for God to demonstrate love for the world. For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son. As was true for Mary, our lives also present us with invitations to help Jesus take flesh, to make God's love for the world visible. The words of Meister Eckhart, 13th century Dominican, emphasize this. He said, "We are all meant to be mothers of God. What good is it to me if this eternal birth of the divine Son takes place unceasingly, but does not take place within me? And what good is it to me if Mary is full of grace, if I am not also full of grace? What good is it to me for the Creator to give birth to his Son, if I do not also give birth to him in my time and my culture? This then is the fullness of time, when the Son of Man is begotten in us." I believe that giving birth to Jesus in our time and culture means saying yes to the invitation to live the gospel of Jesus every day. When we reflect seriously on this gospel, and when we see deeply the world in which we live, we cannot help but be challenged to work to bring our reality into closer conformity with gospel demands. That challenge means working toward the elimination of everything in our society that does not respect and sustain the basic dignity, fundamental rights, and decent quality of life for all persons. I believe that this work is what gives birth to Jesus in our time and culture. A poem written about the Annunciation by Bishop Robert Morneau, auxiliary of Green Bay, Wisconsin, in the United States, is one of my favorites.
Were others asked? A lassie from an isle in a distant sea, a maiden in the North Africa, or a slave girl from the Congo? How many times were angels sent and returned, unheard, unheeded? Was Mary 10th on salvation's list, or the hundreds? And you, my soul, was fiat spoken when the angel came?
As we celebrate God's announcement to Mary of Nazareth, the word that made her the mother of God, let us commit ourselves to continue to nurture the Word of God within us. And may Jesus continue to take flesh as we more authentically live his gospel.
And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.